In this Friday edition, we bring you the full recording of the Fireside Chat with Dr. Anthony Fauci, Chief Medical Advisor for the Biden-Harris Administration. He will be addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, vaccinations, social distancing, what may be a new normal. This Fireside Chat is an event of the COVID Collaborative, a nationwide organization of states and governors and ethnic organizations, health organizations, people working together to find a safer way of life and ultimately finding ways to stop the pandemic conditions of COVID-19, similar to that of how the world stopped the spread of measles. The Fireside Chat.
We're partnering with the Ad Council on a historic vaccine education campaign, Spearheadency to Sustainably Reopening Schools. In everything we do, we reflect a basic public health consensus that transcends political divisions, as exemplified by our co-chairs and moderators today, former Governor Kemp Thorne, Republican of Idaho, and former Governor Deval Patrick, Democrat of Massachusetts. Our guest today also transcends political divisions, having served seven presidents through multiple crises, from HIV/AIDS to Ebola, and now COVID-19. To each of these crises, I've seen him bring three things: a laser-like focus on science and fact, unflinching candor, and deep compassion. The director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases for the last 36 years, architect of PEPFAR, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, chief medical advisor to the Biden-Harris campaign, physician, scientist, we welcome Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Thank you very much, Gary.
And Tony, we appreciate your time. And so let me turn it over to Deval Patrick to lead off our today's discussion.
Thank you, Gary, and welcome, Dr. Fauci. Let me also add my thanks for all you do and have done for our country. Just jumping right in, COVID-19 has now killed more Americans, we've been told, than were killed in World War II. We've seen surge after surge, and now the virus is mutating. Has COVID-19 been harder to control than other pandemics? If so, why? And what do we need to do to get control of this pandemic?
Well, Governor, in answer to your last question first, the ultimate control of pandemics of this type will always rest in the development of a highly effective and safe vaccine. And that's probably one of the few good news aspects of what's gone on over the last year, in that we do have at least two, going on three, and probably closer to four or five in the United States alone, not to mention the vaccines that other countries such as Russia and China, India, and others have done. We have safe and highly efficacious vaccine. It becomes a question of actually getting them implemented and out to people, and to do it as quickly, efficiently, and expeditiously as possible. We have challenges with the vaccine in that we are now seeing the evolution of mutants, or sometimes referred to as variants, which can elude some of the protective effect of vaccine. But fortunately for us, even the ones that are the most problematic are still able to be controlled, at least with respect to severe disease, by the vaccines that we have currently available. But very quickly, let me get to the first question that you asked, Governor, because it really is very important. As you've heard, I've had the opportunity, the privilege of being involved in addressing pandemics over the last more than 36 years since I became director of the Institute of Infectious Diseases at NIH. I have never seen anything like this particular virus in its complexity and its ability to elude what we're trying to do to contain it. One of the most perplexing aspects of it is that for a vaccine that has the capability of doing what it has done, namely killing over 450,000 Americans thus far, about 40% of all of the infections have no symptoms whatsoever. It just doesn't bother anyone at all. And about 59% of the transmissions that occur from one person to another occur from someone who either has no symptoms and never will develop symptoms or is pre-symptomatic, which makes it extraordinarily difficult to do identification, isolation, and contact tracing when the spread of the infection is fundamentally by people who don't know that they are infected. Mm. Most outbreaks, clearly, you stay away from six people and you're pretty much protected. That's absolutely not the case, which I believe has led to a lot of confusion and difficulty with messaging when we're trying to get young people to avoid infection, when they look around and see that many of their colleagues and friends get infected and don't even know it. And yet on the other side of the coin, the elderly and people with underlying conditions are being devastated by this virus. So it is a much most unusual and unique experience that we're going through.
Thank you.
So Dr. Fauci, I want to add my thanks to you and my respect for you for the over four decades of absolute dedicated public service. As Bridge mentioned, in some of my former roles as a governor, a mayor, a U.S. senator, I have a sense of what our decision makers are going through. There are many, many people throughout the United States that are skeptics of this whole thing. They don't want to wear their mask. They don't want to get vaccinated. They don't believe the pandemic is as serious as the more media portrays. For example, as you indicated, there are 450,000 COVID deaths. However, we have comorbidity. I would imagine not all 450,000 are caused by COVID. In fact, we have doctors that are saying states are overstating the death rate. CDC has not helped the cause because they've been inconsistent, if not conflicting, in some of the messages that they have put out. So when we talk about this, what can you say to the skeptics in this atmosphere so that we can realize what is real and what must we do at this point?
Well, Governor, the thing that's so important to point out, again, something that is so unique and strange for this outbreak, is that it is definitely real. When you look at the deaths and the cases and the hospitalizations, it's like nothing we've ever seen before. I think the idea about saying that there are really not that many deaths because people are dying of other things and not COVID, they have comorbidities, but the cause of death almost certainly is COVID. I would venture to guess that there are many people who have died of COVID that have become unnoticed because they never got to the hospital. So I think it's a wash. It's balanced one way or the other, that the issues where you think people maybe have died from a heart attack and they just coincidentally happen to have COVID are balanced by people who have COVID and died from COVID that went unnoticed because of the fact that they didn't have the opportunity to get a proper diagnosis. Putting that aside, the thing that's really strange about this, Governor, is that the idea of thinking that this is a hoax is stunning to me. I mean, I have been involved in interacting in certain states, in certain regions of the country, where the hospitals are being overrun with people who are sick enough to require intensive care. Hospitals in places where you have 20 intensive care beds and 50 people who require intensive care. And even in that setting, when you talk to people in that region, they still think it's a hoax. They think it's fake news. Well, I have to tell you, from someone who's lived through multiple pandemics and multiple outbreaks, this is not fake news. How do we get around that? That is a very difficult task, Governor, because one of the things that is also unique about this outbreak is that never have I seen such divisiveness in our society. And if ever there was a time when you needed everyone to be uniformly pulling together, wearing a mask, avoiding close contact, avoiding congregate settings, it would be in the middle of an outbreak. Yet, unfortunately for us, we've had this outbreak evolve at a time in our own society where the divisiveness has been profound. Superimposed upon that, an election year, which made divisiveness even more problematic. So there were so many unique aspects to this outbreak that make it very, very challenging.
Doctor, if I could just follow up on Governor Kempthorne's question, you know, this notion that we could politicize a public health emergency is astounding to me, much more so, I'm sure, to you, given your experience. And in the first 100 days of the Biden administration, the emphasis has been on wearing a mask. At the same time, more and more people are getting vaccinated and feeling, if I may say, in some cases, safe. And yet, how do we get folks to understand and accept the point you and others have made that getting vaccinated and wearing a mask beyond that 100-day target is important?
Well, it is important because even though it is very clear that the vaccines that people get are 94 to 95% effective, the endpoint, the primary endpoint of the study, is clinically recognizable disease. So it is conceivable, possibly likely, but certainly conceivable, that you could get protected from symptomatic infection because you are vaccinated and still have the vaccine, still have the virus infect you without you knowing it and have virus in your nasopharynx, which means that you could theoretically and maybe practically transmit the virus even though you're not sick and you've been vaccinated. And that's the reason why we recommend that people who get vaccinated still, under most circumstances, wear a mask more to protect others from getting infected than necessarily protecting yourself. When we get the overwhelming majority of the population vaccinated and get what we call herd immunity, which we can talk about later, the fact is that you still have to abide by public health measures. I mean, people will be asking a very obvious question. If I'm gonna get vaccinated, what is there different than I'm gonna be doing? Well, until we get the community level of infection very low so that it's no longer a public health threat, we still, vaccinated or not, need to abide by public health measures.
Dr. Fauci, let me follow up on that then. What is that percent? You say we must get a large amount of the public that will be vaccinated. What is herd immunity? Once we achieve that, and you say we have to continue the other practices, how long, once we achieve herd immunity, do we still have to have the masks? When do we return to normal? Are we ever?
Yeah, good question. We will. It may be slightly different than the normal that we had before, in that there'll be this recognition of the extraordinary potential of respiratory diseases causing havoc in our society. So herd immunity, the concept of herd immunity means that if you get, and it really depends, and I'll give you an example that I think will clarify it, Governor. A herd immunity really depends on the ability of the virus to transmit. The more transmissible it is, the greater proportion of the population you would need to be vaccinated to get herd immunity. And the higher the degree of efficacy of the vaccine, the better chance you have of achieving herd immunity. Herd immunity means that when you get a certain percentage of the population vaccinated or already infected and thus protected against reinfection, that the virus in the community will have very little wiggle room to infect anybody. And it comes down to the, you know, to the metaphor of when you have a herd of animals, just, you know, think of a herd of wildebeest, and you got baby wildebeest and old wildebeest that can't protect themselves against the lion that's trying to get a meal, that when you get the herd that surrounds the vulnerables, it's very difficult to get anybody to hurt the vulnerables. So you have literally a blanket of protection over society, which we metaphorically refer to as herd immunity. We know for sure with measles, because we have decades of experience with measles, that measles is so highly transmissible, the most transmissible virus you can imagine, that you need an extremely high percentage of the population to be vaccinated, over 90%, The reason we know that is we have experience as recently as a couple of years ago, where certain communities got the level of vaccination in the community below a certain level, like in the 80s as opposed to in the 90s. We saw that with the Orthodox Jewish population in New York City that went below a certain level, and there were clear outbreaks that essentially overrode herd immunity. Given the fact that this virus is not quite as transmissible as measles, and the vaccine is very good, 94%, 95%, but not quite as good as measles vaccine, which is 98%, that you can do a guesstimate, and it's purely an estimate. No one knows yet what the level is. I would imagine it's somewhere between 70 and 85%. So in direct answer to your question, if we can get 85% of our population vaccinated and get really good herd immunity, the level of protection in the population would be so good that the level of virus would not be a threat. When we get there, which I think we can, I think then we could really pull back on some of the public health constraints we have, like mask wearing, not being able to have indoor dining in a restaurant, not being able to go to a theater or a movie. I think that will loosen up greatly when we reach that level of protection.
Thank you.
Dr. Fauci, the pandemic has exposed a lot of America's unfinished business. And I'm thinking in particular about healthcare disparities in outcome and access and outcomes for Black and Brown people. What is the administration doing to, as it rolls out the vaccine and otherwise advises on public health policy, to address those inequities, and what should states be doing as well?
Okay, so let me just take a minute, Governor, to let the audience appreciate the importance of your question. When you say disparities and inequities, they are really severe. And as you were alluding to, I think, saying that this outbreak has shed a very bright light on a failing in society that's been there for decades and decades. But every once in a while, when you get a beam of light shone upon it, everybody realizes it. And that is that Brown and Black people suffer disproportionately, not only that they get infected more frequently because the nature of the jobs that most of them have put them out in society in essential jobs that make society run. Therefore, instead of being in front of a computer, they're out there getting exposed, so they get infected more. Then they have a much greater incidence and prevalence of the underlying comorbidities, which clearly are associated with a greater degree of hospitalization and a greater degree of death. And that is the things we know that Brown and Black people have much more than the general population: diabetes, hypertension, chronic lung disease, liver disease, kidney disease, obesity. All of those things make for the fact that when a Brown or Black person gets infected, the chances of their getting serious disease or dying is substantially greater than the general population and certainly than white people. Having said that, we're very much aware of that. So when you get to the issue of testing, but particularly vaccine, what the president has done as part of his plan, the strategic plan that he put out about a week and a half ago, is outreach into the minority population with community vaccine centers, with putting vaccines in pharmacies that are located in areas accessible to Brown and Black people, to do mobile units to go into not easily accessible areas and neighborhoods. And then finally, to put in place an inequities or an equity task force to address the inequities and to assign a person whose only job is to look at that. And that's an African-American physician, Marcella Nunes Smith from Yale, who is actually responsible for leading that task force.
Thank you.
Dr. Fauci, let's talk about children. I know I have five little grandkids that are watching this particular interview. In fact, they just sent me a little picture and a note, you know, you're doing good. So schools are safe to open. I've read that. Parents are struggling. They're stressed. They have their own work at home, but now they're trying to also help educate the children at home. Children, the concern is they're becoming Zoom zombies. When are we going to open these schools? Is it a situation where once again you have political science and biological science? We have school boards and teachers unions that are at impasse. Are the schools safe? When can we get these schools open? And if you were king for a day, what would you do now to get these schools open and get kids back in school?
Well, President Biden has made it very clear that what he wants to do is to get all kids K to 8 in school within the first 100 days. Now, obviously, you're very well aware, Governor, because you alluded to it, to the conflict, teachers unions, parents, et cetera, et cetera. The default position should be to do whatever we possibly can to get children to get back to school and stay in school for the very reasons that you alluded to. The disruption, psychologically and otherwise, to the children, the impact on working families. So the CDC, literally within the next few days, I would imagine, I don't want to get ahead of them, but I would imagine before the end of the week, going to be coming out with guidelines to try and help to get the children. We want to get the Relief Act to be able to get resources to schools to provide what they need to make it more safe for the children. Now, if I were king for a day, I would do something that even being king for a day wouldn't allow me to do. I would have enough vaccine to vaccinate all the teachers and get even the children vaccinated, which we'll have to wait until the clinical trials show that. But we're getting there. We're going in the right direction. The one thing I can tell you, I totally agree with you on, that we need to get the children back to school for sure.
I appreciate that greatly. So do the kids.
Yeah. Dr. Fauci, we're hearing reports of these new variants from the UK and South Africa, maybe more infectious, potentially more deadly. And some even resistant to the vaccine. I wonder if you could help us sort out truth from fiction in that respect, and what more we can do in the wake of these variants to protect ourselves.
Well, SARS coronavirus 2, Governor, is an RNA virus, which means it very readily mutates. It mutates when you put pressure on it. Either immunological pressure when it infects someone, or therapeutic pressure when you try to treat it, but they continually mutate. Most of the mutations don't have any functional relevance. They don't change the function of the virus. They don't make it more infectious. They don't make it more virulent. And it has very little to do with protection of the vaccine. But every once in a while, a combination of mutations occur that create what's called a variant or a new lineage, which does have functional consequences. We're dealing with a few of them now. Two examples, you mentioned them. Let me give you some details about it because it's important for people to understand. There's a lineage and it comes by strange letters and names, like B117 is the lineage that is dominant now in the UK. Mm-hmm. It has been shown by the Brits to be more easily transmissible. And although there's some conflict about this, there is some suggestion that it's more virulent. Namely, it makes you sicker and leads to serious consequences more than the wild type virus. That mutant, that variant, is now in multiple states in the United States and has been documented in several hundred people. The modelers who study viral dynamics give an indication that by the time we get to the end of March, that variant will be dominant in the United States. So what do we do about that? Fortunately, the vaccine that we now have, the two vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer, are really quite adequate in preventing that infection. So the vaccine works well against the infection. So it's kind of a race to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible, as well as doubling down on public health measures to prevent the potential dominance of this more threatening variant, threatening because it transmits more quickly. Now, there's another variant that's more problematic, and that's the one in South Africa. That's called B351. Now, B351 is totally dominating in South Africa. And one of the issues is that it does elude some of the monoclonal antibodies that we use for treatment, and the vaccine-induced antibodies are not quite as protective against this variant as against the wild type. It doesn't obviate protection at all. You still get protection for sure, but it isn't as good. The thing that is the somewhat comforting news is that the vaccines do protect against severe disease like hospitalization and deaths. So it is much more challenging. So what we're doing about it is we're already starting to make upgraded versions of the vaccine so that in case, and I say in case because we may not necessarily have to do this, in case that South African variant does become more dominant in the United States, we'll be able to give people a booster shot with a vaccine that is directed specifically against the South African strain. But we don't have to do that yet because it isn't dominant here.
Thank you. Dr. Fauci, last week the White House announced a massive spending program for the rapid over-the-counter at-home COVID test. Are those real? Is that a game changer? And then add to that, what can the rest of us do that it may be months before we get a vaccine to build up our immune system? Are there things we can be doing? And if I can, are we doing enough to find the cure and not just the vaccine?
Okay, three good questions. The rapid antigen test that you can now get in a pharmacy without a prescription and get an answer within 15 minutes, where the federal government, is investing several hundred million dollars to scale up that so that we can get up to 19 million of these per month. The answer to your question, Governor, it is a game changer, because if you can really do surveillance and know whether you or a number of people are infected, if you were going to have a meeting of a board of directors and you wanted to make sure that you wanted to bring them in, you could test them, have them wait outside in the lobby and find out in 15 minutes if they were infected or not. That could be a game changer about how we interact with each other. That's for sure. The idea of therapy as opposed to just a vaccine to prevent, you're absolutely correct. We have a long way to go. We've developed spectacular drugs for HIV that have changed and transformed the lives of HIV-infected individuals. We've cured hepatitis C with direct-acting agents. It's going to take a little bit of time, but with the proper attention and investment, we could get, I'm sure, I'm almost guaranteeing it, that we could get really good drugs for SARS-CoV-2, for sure. With regard to building up immunity, you know, there really isn't, even though there's a lot of these herbs and other things that people take, that's more placebo than anything else. The best way to get your immune system good is to literally do things that seem simplistic. Do exercise, good diet, plenty of sleep, avoid stress. You do that, it makes your immune system as healthy or more healthy than taking a whole bunch of pills.
Even vitamin C, zinc, those things?
No. Actually, it's interesting. If there are some people who are actually deficient in vitamin D, and if you are, that can make you more susceptible to some of these infections. So we recommend that if people are either borderline normal or deficient in vitamin D, to take some supplemental vitamin D. Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Dr. Frosty, let's take some questions from our guests. Just following up on the kids question that Governor Kempthorne just asked, Melanie from Allstate has a question about vaccines. Right now, she says there's nothing approved for under 15 or 16 year olds. When can we expect a vaccine for children younger than that? And what is your take on the effectiveness of plexiglass and plastic dividers? I presume in classrooms.
Yeah. Okay. So as with any vaccine, you don't approve a vaccine for children because they are vulnerable in so many ways, including the lack of their ability to give informed consent. So you've got to be really careful when you do any intervention in a child. Because of that, the general guidelines are that you wait until a vaccine has been shown to clearly be safe and effective in normal adults before you start allowing it to be given to children. So given that, we've already started and will continue to do what's called age de-escalation testing. Namely, you do a phase one or a phase 2A study in children, first from 16 to 12, 12 to 9, 9 to 5, until you get down to the lowest age possible. When those studies are complete, which likely will be in several months, we will then bridge those studies to the efficacy studies in adults and make vaccines available for children. Short answer to the caller's question, it will take at least a few months, if not longer, before we get it for younger children. The idea of plexiglass around desks or what have you, you know, you may have some protection against droplets that spray out from an individual, but you know, that's not the only way that viruses spread. There's aerosol where they sort of float around over and above. So I would think the following: the study has not been done, so you can't give an official recommendation. But as I always say, common sense is a good thing sometimes. It can't hurt. I don't think it can make matters worse. And it possibly could prevent the spread of these larger droplets. So if people want to put a plastic or plexiglass shield, I have no problem with that. But it is not.
I'm not a substitute for mask wearing. For
no, there you go. You said the absolutely important thing. Not at all a substitute for mask wearing. Mm-hmm. Right.
Great. Thank you.
Governor Patrick always comes through with good information. So our next question just sent in from a friend of mine, Tim Shriver, and imagine a friend of yours, Dr. Fauci.
Yes.
What are the mental health symptoms of COVID? And should we combine vaccination efforts with mental health efforts?
Well, as usual, Tim is right on the money with that. Absolutely. The mental health stress and strain on COVID in the community, forgetting what might happen as a symptom of getting infected yourself, putting that aside, and look at the stress on the children, the stress on families. If you look at some of the things that have gone on in society, they're objective manifestations of it. Suicide increases, domestic violence, alcoholism, and things like that. It is a very stressful situation that we should never, ever underestimate. What we've been through this past year is nothing like any of our parents or grandparents have experienced. They've experienced stressful times of depression, world wars, and things like that. But this is right up there with that. You know, to be a cloud of danger over you for an entire year, seeing people, your loved ones, getting infected and dying, that is a very stressful situation. So Tim is quite correct. This is something we need to pay attention to.
Dr. Fauci, one of our audience members has a two-part question. I think you may have answered the first part. Will there need to be a booster to the current vaccine to encompass the variants, or a separate vaccine? I think you addressed that earlier. The second part is for the people receiving the two-dose vaccine now, How long will it last? And is there a revaccination plan for them?
Okay, so you're correct, Governor. I did answer that. There will be, if we need it, a booster shot that contains a specific addressing of the variant, as well as the possibility that if these viruses continue to evolve, you may need to upgrade the vaccine so that you revaccinate people in a year or two or whatever. That's conceivable. I mean, we're putting that, not everything is on the table. We don't feel we need to do that right now, but that's certainly something we think about.
So it could become like the annual flu shot.
It's possible. I hope not. I hope we could nail this down without requiring having to chase after it year after year, but you have to be prepared for that. The answer to the second question is unknown because we only have experience of less than a year with the vaccine. So we do not know how long the durability of the protection of the two-dose vaccine or even of the single-dose vaccine that Johnson & Johnson is going to come out with quite soon in the next few weeks. We will know as we follow people over a period of months to more than a year. But right now we know it's at least 6 months or longer, but we don't know if it's a year and a half, 2 years, but future experience will give us the answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you.
So Dr. Fauci, we received a question from the audience, and it really follows what you have just said. For people receiving the two-dose vaccine, how long will it last? I hear you say maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's longer. Do you believe that the Johnson & Johnson, which apparently is a one shot, is that going to have a longer duration? Or again, we just have to wait and see on this. And may I addendum to that? During this COVID period, what has happened to the common cold? Has it declined because people have been wearing masks?
Yeah, okay. So just to reiterate my answer to the prior question, you're absolutely right. Even with the Johnson & Johnson, we're going to have to wait and see the durability of the protection of the one dose J&J, as well as the two dose Moderna and Pfizer. But boy, what an interesting question you asked, because there is a good answer to it. So as we were going through our summer, this past summer, Australia was going through their winter. So they tend to have their flu season when it's their winter and our summer. And I was getting calls from my scientific colleagues in Australia, some of which we've actually trained in our labs, saying, Tony, something strange is going on here. We're not seeing any influenza at all when we usually see thousands and thousands and thousands of cases in our winter. And we think it's because we're wearing masks, we're physically distancing, and we're avoiding congregate settings. And we're not even seeing common cold. People are not getting respiratory-borne illnesses. I said, wow, wouldn't that be interesting if when we get to our fall and winter, the same thing happens? And son of a gun, that's exactly what's happened. We've had the lowest influenza season thus far than we've had in a long time. So what it tells us, that it's proof positive that wearing masks, avoiding congregate settings, keeping your distance and washing your hands absolutely protects you against respiratory-borne illness.
Wow. Dr. Fauci, suppose all but the 30% or so of Americans are vaccinated, 30% or so who say, I don't trust and I don't want a vaccine. What happens then?
Well, it's bad for them because what will likely happen is that a certain percentage of them will get infected and a certain percentage of them get sick. It would also weaken somewhat our goal of getting a real herd immunity where you get 85% of the people vaccinated. So it wouldn't destroy the protection for the rest of the community, but it wouldn't make it as absolute as what you see, for example, with measles. When you vaccinate 90 some odd percent of the population, you don't see any measles in society. If you really want to get to the point where you don't see any more COVID or SARS-CoV-2, you really want to vaccinate the overwhelming proportion of the population, which brings us to a subject we haven't brought up that I think it's worthy of mentioning, that this is a global pandemic. Mm-hmm. So what happens in the rest of the world will continually to impact what happens here. So even though we have a degree of protection by a high level of vaccination, if you have this disease rampant in the rest of the world, it's going to continually threaten us, mm-hmm. which is the reason why the idea of developing a global consortium and a global effort referred to as COVAX, where rich countries like the United States and the European Union and Canada and Australia are making investments to be able to get the people in countries in the world that are less fortunate regarding economic capabilities to make sure that we vaccinate the whole world, mm-hmm. the way we did with smallpox, the way we did with polio, the way we did with measles. Otherwise, it will always be a threat.
Mm-hmm. Because it's in our common interest.
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Fauci, our next question returns to the national audience, but it really is the universality of it. The question is, could we have a nationwide plan instead of every state and county doing things differently? And I want to give compliments to governors, incumbent governors, who have joined the COVID collaborative working together. And there's no partisanship in that.
Well, thank you, Governor, for bringing that up, because, months ago, I don't know whether you were following it that closely, I had been saying so often that the way to a successful addressing of this outbreak is to have cooperation, collaboration, and synergy between the federal government and the states. Mm-hmm. The states are really good. Governors know what they're doing. Mayors know what they're doing. Yeah. But you've got to be able to give them a plan. You've got to be able to give them some goals. And you've got to be able to give them resources to carry out these plans and these goals. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that we didn't do very well several months ago, because what the general trend was, leave the states on their own to do what they need to do, and don't get the federal government very deeply involved. You certainly don't want the federal government to do everything, but you really want the federal government to be a full-blown partner with the states and with the cities to address this, because there's a great deal of commonality. Even though we respect the federalist approach of states doing things differently, when you're dealing with a common enemy, there are certain commonalities that you have to follow, because the virus doesn't know the difference between Montana and Idaho or between Wyoming and whatever states surround it. You just, it is one country and one virus.
Mm-hmm. If I might, and Deval, if you'll excuse me for this, but just to make your point, during Katrina, the C-130 was the airplane that brought so much relief and took people that were needed to be evacuated. 85% of C-130s were ordered by governors, 15% by the federal government. So it shows you how rapid governors can be in response, but there needs to be a coordinated effort.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
Common enemy, as you say, in common response. Just to wrap up on a lighter note from one of our audience members, what do you do to take your mind off of all of this from time to time? Do you have a favorite streaming show? And what snacks do you like to binge on when you're watching?
Well, Governor, I have to say, sadly, but understandably, I don't really take much time off at all. The one thing I do every day is I try to do some exercise. And that is like to power walk or run for 3 or 4 miles every day. I used to do that during the middle of the day prior to COVID, but since I'm wall to wall busy from 5 in the morning until late at night, I do it at night in my neighborhood in Northwest Washington, D.C. I do a power walk throughout the neighborhood. So if you see some guy and his wife running through the streets, that's me and my wife. And I what do I really like as a really bad snack? I'm a hot dog lover, Governor, and if you give me a good Nathan's hot dog, that's all I need.
Once a New Yorker, always a New Yorker. Well, that brings our time together. Sorry, Dirk?
No, go ahead, Patrick. Governor Patrick, I want to make a final comment, and then we'll let Dr. Fauci have the last word.
Great. Well, I was just going to say this does bring our session to a close, and I want to thank you, Dr. Fauci, for participating today, for answering questions you've been asked a million times, but doing it for a group of people who are deeply concerned about aligning around a common strategy to face down this common enemy. We thank you for your leadership. I also want to take an opportunity to thank Gary and Bridge, and especially my co-chair, Governor Dirk Kempthorne, for their extraordinary leadership and their vision in pulling us together into this COVID collaborative, in that very same spirit I refer to in my last comment to you, Dr. Fauci. So Dirk, over to you. Thank you.
Governor Patrick, you are an absolute joy to work with. I appreciate your leadership, and you're so result-oriented, and also Bridge and Gary, and the entire COVID collaborative. Dr. Fauci, you know this, but we've talked about all these different topics, but the organization of the COVID collaborative, it includes the NAACP, UNIDOS, the Congress of American Native Americans. It has the Urban League. It has the Business Roundtable. It has the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers. It has the medical community, the scientific community, the former secretaries of education, regardless of the party affiliation. So, and we also have a number of governors that have now signed on to this COVID collaborative, working together across those state lines. So we think that, again, this is how we help unite America to defeat a virus that's killing us. So Dr. Fauci, you've been tremendous today. Let me turn to you, sir, with the final word.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Governor Kempthorne and Governor Patrick. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this, because we really need to get answers to the questions. Every single one of your questions that you asked were really right on. You're right. I get asked it all the time. And the reason I do is because they're important questions. And the only way you're going to get them answered is to just answer them for the American public. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to be with you. And thank my good friend, Gary Etzen, for being part of this.
Great. God bless all of us.
You have been listening to a recording of the COVID Collaborative Fireside Chat with Dr. Anthony Fauci. This has been a special Friday edition presentation by KIDE Hoopah.